Countries have had a hard time keeping anything secret lately. Can they do a better job keeping their promises? I'm Greg Dalton, host of Climate One, and today we're talking about promises made in Paris at the International Climate Summit. Last year, leaders from 195 countries joined a pledge to go on a carbon diet. Countries laid out voluntary plans for growing their economies while cutting carbon pollution. Now comes the hard work and sweat. On the show today, I'll ask Secretary of Energy Ernest Moniz how the United States, China, and other big economies are going to start running cleaner. Along the way, we'll include questions from our live audience at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco. The second half of the program, I'll talk with investors and entrepreneurs about clean energy technologies, investing, and what individuals can do to lead a greener life. We begin with Ernest Moniz, who was a longtime professor of physics and engineering at MIT before joining President Obama's cabinet in 2013. He played a key role in negotiating the Iranian nuclear deal and the Paris Climate Agreement. Please welcome Secretary Moniz to the Commonwealth Club.
Thank you, Greg. Thank you.
Secretary Moniz, welcome back. I'd like to begin, obviously the Paris Climate Agreement was a big deal, 195 countries coming together, but the New York Times recently ran a lead story saying that the current low costs of fossil fuels and turmoil and concern about an economic downturn is presenting a challenge for the Paris Agreement. And they quoted Fatih Birol, the executive director of the International Energy Agency, saying, quote, "This will be a litmus test for the governments, whether or not they are serious about what they have done in Paris." So how is the U.S. going to make good on the Paris deal? And is the current low cost of fossil fuels kind of wind in the face?
Well, certainly the low cost of oil affects certain parts of the sector. I mean, it's put a dent into some of the electric vehicle sales. It provides a higher challenge, if you like, for next generation biofuels. But on the other hand, I have to say I feel pretty confident that that we will be able to move forward pretty aggressively. Let me make a few points. First of all, we should remember that certainly in the United States, oil has essentially no role in the power sector. And there we are continuing to see the very, very strong growth of wind and solar and other renewables. I think that will certainly continue, particularly as we continue to drive down the costs very, very dramatically in these areas. If we go to transportation, obviously that's where oil has the dominant role. But let me point out that we continue to push hard in three directions. One is the continued electrification of vehicles, and we are now over 400,000 electric vehicles on the road in this country. California probably leading the way. Secondly, we continue to develop advanced biofuels, and certainly the requirements for at least a minimal biofuel component are not going away. Obviously, we'd like to see movement towards the more advanced biofuels. But third, we will continue to push in terms of efficiency of vehicles. And something like the CAFE standards, which have us reaching well over 50 miles per gallon for new light-duty vehicles in 2025, those do not depend upon the oil price. Those are there. We are now at an actual fleet average of about 25 miles per gallon and heading up, as I said, to new vehicle 50-plus miles per gallon in 2025. So I think we will keep making this progress. And as we see exciting technology developments, you probably have seen the recent administration commitment to self-driving vehicles. That is coming at us so much faster than anybody expected. And when you think about that, it's a pathway, again, to further electrification and to offering all kinds of new services to people. So I think it's very exciting. Oil prices go up and down, and that will continue to be the case. We have a longer-term perspective in terms of the technology and the policies to continue on our decarbonization path.
Americans love technology, but a lot of times technology has unintended consequences. Self-driving cars, for example, some experts are concerned that if you're not driving the car, you don't care if it's stuck in traffic for 2 hours, so there could be more cars circulating around if I don't have to be worried about stuck in gridlock. So they could result in more carbon emissions than less.
Well, first of all, if it's a purely electric vehicle being supplied by renewable sources, I wouldn't worry about the emissions so much. But look, I don't think people are going to be happy to be sitting in one spot for a long time.
But their car is without them in it.
Look, there will be system challenges to be met, system design. There will be urban redesign that will naturally flow from this. So, you know, if you go back 10 years and look at the energy world, it looks very, very different from today in so many ways, in the power sector, with renewables, obviously in terms of our oil and gas production, it's night and day. I think 10 years from now, we have a hard enough time understanding what it was like 10 years ago. We have a lot harder time understanding what it's going to be like 10 years from now. And we're going to push on technology. And in fact, one of the themes that I'd like to really get to today is in Paris, there is a lot of focus, deservedly so, on the commitments that were made by essentially every country in the world to lowering carbon emissions. But I'd like to also point, and please come back to, the very beginning of the meeting in Paris, a commitment to innovation, technology innovation, as central to meeting our goals, was also there. And that is absolutely critical because as we go down one decade, two decades, three decades, our ambition is going to have to get even greater, and that's going to be enabled by the technology innovation that continues to drive down costs and continues to provide us surprises in terms of new kinds of services that we can offer people.
Well, one of the ambitious goals that's out there, a couple of presidential candidates have endorsed 100% renewable energy for the United States. Is that possible with existing technology, or do you think new innovations are required to get the United States to 100% renewable?
Look, we are seeing dramatic cost reductions. If we look just in the last 6 years, let's say, we have seen cost reductions of 40, 50, 60, 40, 50, 70, and 90%, I believe it is, respectively, for onshore wind, for PV, for batteries, for LEDs. LEDs is an incredible story in terms of the cost reduction and the associated deployment. And by the way, something I'd like to come back to as well, called the Clean Energy Ministerial, that we will be hosting here in San Francisco in June. It has led the way in terms of getting worldwide deployment of LEDs at huge scale. India is an incredible story. So look, there's a lot here to feel really good about. But nevertheless, we still want those breakthrough technology innovations that can be game changers. Sunlight to fuels would be an example of one that does not violate the laws of physics, but we have a long way to go yet. It could just be you know, tremendous game changers in front of us. So I think with Paris, we saw the countries of the world essentially all acknowledging the critical importance of addressing climate change. We saw a set of national commitments to get there. I believe we will see countries, by and large, aggressively working to meet those targets. Certainly, the United States, we believe that we are certainly on track. Clearly, we'd love to see additional policy innovation as well in working with Congress, but we are on track, and I will continue to insist that innovation will be a big part of the story.
In any particular sectors, is it battery storage? You mentioned sunlight to fuels. I think you mean transportation fuels.
Correct.
Lighting, buildings. Where would you like to see new investors, new innovation happen?
All of the above. We need it across the board. If we are going to go to a world where carbon emissions and economic growth are not proportional, we're going to need very, very strong demand side progress. So efficiency, LEDs, buildings, you name it. We're going to need a lot of fuel switching, shall I say, where I'm using fuel here generally, including renewables. We're seeing today the shift from coal to gas, natural gas, as a big part of our carbon reductions, for example. And we will have, I believe, a contribution not only from the zero carbon technologies, but also carbon dioxide capture will play a role. And I would note that with carbon capture, you know, we have a lot of attention, and I don't want to take attention away from the issue of capturing carbon from coal plants, etc. But we have a lot of industrial facilities that emit a lot of carbon dioxide for which there is, in some sense, no practical alternative other than carbon capture, perhaps utilizing the carbon dioxide. So it's got to be across the board, and it's got to be in the power sector, in the industrial sector, in the transportation sector.
You've mentioned falling prices in wind, solar, fossil fuel prices also have fallen. One area where prices have not fallen is nuclear. Prices have risen. There hasn't been a whole lot of innovation there. A few years ago, there was a talk of a nuclear renaissance in the United States. A few new plants were started. Some old ones have been retired. Where are you on nuclear now as part of this Paris pledge?
Well, look, we still think that nuclear is one of the options that will play an important role in some places and not so important a role in other places for a variety of reasons. Some of it is societal decisions. Germany is an obvious example. Part of it can be regulatory structures. For example, in the United States, it's not an accident that the new plants are being built in the Southeast, where the cost recovery is available. We're seeing in China a tremendous build-out of nuclear power as part of their zero carbon. But looking ahead, I will just go back to the innovation theme. One very, in my view, very promising direction are what's called small modular reactors, where rather than building increasingly large nuclear plants, sometimes 1,400 megawatts, and requiring, you know, $15 billion of capital for two units, instead going towards much smaller units, we are supporting at the Department of Energy one that will be heading towards NRC license applications this year for a 50 megawatt unit, very good safety features, etc. What we don't know and won't know until it plays out is what is going to be the full cost, where the efficiencies of manufacturing can be brought to bear, but will that overcome the efficiencies of scale? So these are open questions, but that's why we are investing in an R&D portfolio and moving forward.
Talking today at Climate One at the Commonwealth Club with U.S. Secretary of Energy Ernest Moniz. I'm Greg Dalton. I'd like to go to a lightning round. We have a brief number of yes or no questions for Secretary Moniz. The first one...
I don't do yes or no very well.
Oh, well, too many years as a professor, right? Wired for 50 minutes.
Right.
First one is, coal is a dying industry in the United States. Yes or no?
Sorry, but as a look, obviously the coal share of electricity production has dropped substantially. In fact, in the last year, for 5 months, natural gas for the first time supplied more electricity than coal. That's where something like carbon capture and sequestration comes in to have a continuing role for coal in a low carbon world.
A young child today will fly on a battery-powered airplane in their lifetime.
How far?
and survive. Yeah. Next question. Your 1970s haircut gave you style points when negotiating deals in Paris and Tehran.
Give me a break.
Sarah Palin has said she would like to be energy secretary under Donald Trump if he becomes president. What do you think of that?
Well, I hope she will focus on the nuclear stockpile as well. But I believe she also added that she would like to provide more access to federal lands. That's not one of our responsibilities.
You mentioned you're hosting the group of energy ministers from around the world in San Francisco later this year. Would you have really wanted to host them in Las Vegas, but the carbon footprint of the Las Vegas Strip was just too large?
No, we wanted to host them in San Francisco. And let me make actually a very serious point. The Clean Energy Ministerial is composed of 23 countries plus the EU. We believe now, post-Paris, the Clean Energy Ministerial can be a premier organization for seeing to the Paris implementation. So in the last year of this administration, of the Obama administration, we really see this opportunity, again, to link those agendas very strongly. We wanted to come to San Francisco to emphasize the innovation theme. It will be here on June 1st and 2nd. It'll be preceded by what promises to be a fabulous clean energy innovation showcase, I believe in Union Square, by the way, with up to 1,000 innovative technologies on display from the Bay Area, from the United States, and from other countries in the Clean Energy Ministerial. So this is going to be, I think, a very important event to, again, capture momentum out of Paris and to really solidify the innovation theme as core to the future in satisfying the commitments made there.
And that program, that event here in early June in San Francisco. I'd like to play a clip of former Secretary of Treasury Hank Paulson, who was here recently talking about climate, and then get your reaction. This is Hank Paulson, former CEO of Goldman Sachs and Treasury Secretary under the second President Bush.
Well, climate change, I think, is a very difficult issue to deal with. It is, you know, I think the biggest risk, not just to the global ecosystem and the environment, it's the biggest economic risk we face.
So that's a prominent Republican saying climate is a big risk. Where can Republicans and Democrats agree on climate? There was a deal at the budget deal at the end of last year to allow crude oil exports and extend some renewable energy credits. That Democrats and Republicans agreed on that. Where else can Republicans and Democrats agree on climate?
I believe the innovation agenda is really the key. We have, in Paris, as I mentioned earlier, on the very first day, President Obama and the leaders of 19 other countries, mostly the leaders are very high-ranking members of the government, announced this Mission Innovation initiative. We have had extensive discussions about this in the Congress with both chambers, both parties. And the innovation agenda is one that resonates very, very strongly. It's about also, it's advancing business in addition to advancing our climate goals, our security goals, our economic goals. It's also going to be about building new infrastructure. Labor is all into the innovation and infrastructure agenda. So I think the reality is in Paris, certainly no one can dispute the fact that every country in the world basically came forward and said, we have to address this. Now, there may be individuals who would like to take a different position, but I have not heard any of them take a different position on innovation, on the fact that the United States has always led in innovation, that it gives us tremendous opportunity economically, and I think that's the key. So this year, frankly, in the next months, we are going to see as the Congress starts debating an energy bill, as the Congress addresses the appropriations. I can assure you that the administration is committed to its mission innovation commitment of doubling energy technology R&D over the next 5 years. That translates into a 15 to 20% per year, whether you compound or not, increase. We have every intention of certainly trying to work with the Congress to establish that, as will the other 19 countries that have joined with us. And I might add that, and perhaps the next panel will address this, that this Mission Innovation Coalition of 20 countries, expanding the innovation pipeline, it has been done in collaboration with what's called the Breakthrough Energy Coalition, which is 28 investors from 10 different countries putting billions of dollars on the table with increased risk tolerance and patience for returns to get some of these breakthrough energy projects going forward, to really move from end to end in terms of getting these technologies into the marketplace, from early innovation to deployment. So this is tremendous leverage on both public and private sectors. We're getting 20 countries to double to technology R&D to provide more investable opportunities for, frankly, deep-pocketed investors, again, from many, many countries and many continents. So I think this is the message. This is the bipartisan message. This is the message that will, again, I think, carry us across the finish line in terms of the dramatically increased ambition we will need in the decades ahead.
Do you believe that this innovation will allow this transition to happen without lifestyle changes and without increased costs to consumers?
I think net, it will be decreased costs to consumers, particularly in light of the alternatives, as I think Hank Paulson was intimating. As far as lifestyle choices, yeah, I can imagine there will be lifestyle changes. Better lifestyles. I would just note, who knows, but we can dream. We talk about autonomous vehicles. But if you play that out, if that becomes a dramatically deployed technology, especially in urban environments, it's going to suggest a different urban environment, a better one, a cleaner one, a quieter one, with new services. So, you know, I think we are always very limited in our ability to predict. Again, 10 years ago, not many people would have predicted where we are today in terms of energy and the associated implications of energy for our everyday lives. It's only going to be, I think, even more surprising when we look back from 10 and 20 years down the road.
Another surprising headline in the energy world recently is that Saudi Arabia is essentially going to sell the crown jewels. They're going to, Saudi Aramco, the state oil company of Saudi Arabia, is going to have an IPO and sell shares to the public. What does that say to you about an oil state selling? Are they kind of cashing out, hedging their bets on the future of oil?
Well, first of all, I think the statement may have been a little bit too black and white in terms of how they will go forward. There have also been statements to make it very, very clear. There have been statements made, and I don't know what the Saudis will do in the end, but to say that any privatization, if you like, would likely occur on the downstream side and not on the upstream side. But whatever the case, Saudi Arabia is a good example of a country. They are in mission innovation. So they know very well, as do other producing states, that they have to diversify their economies. They have to rely more upon developing trained kind of a technology workforce. They are working at that very hard. I know from my previous life at MIT that they are taking this quite seriously. So whether they IPO part of Saudi Aramco or not, I think is going to be a detail, frankly, in what is their clear commitment to diversification. They are moving forward on renewables, but also if you, in the mission innovation context, and I was in Saudi Arabia to discuss that in November, it's very clear that their portfolio will look different from the portfolio in some other places. They will, for example, put a very high emphasis on the technology development and cost reduction for carbon capture, which would be a pathway to using more fossil fuels, of course, if you can capture the carbon. They will be looking, as we probably will collaborate with them on, things like, it's not fossil fuels per se, but how do you replace the HFCs in air conditioning in warm climates? What are the replacement fluids or the replacement thermodynamics to address cooling in those kinds of areas? It's going to be a fantastically diverse technology palette that they and others will be working from.
Our guest today at Climate One at the Commonwealth Club is U.S. Secretary of Energy Ernest Moniz. I'm Greg Dalton. We're going to invite your participation. We have 7 or 8 minutes left. We'll get through quickly, invite you to join us with a quick question for the secretary, and then we'll go on to our second piece. So brisk is the key word here. Please step on up to the microphone and make your, we'll get through as many of these questions crisply as we can.
Hello, Secretary.
Where's the question? Oh, there it is. Okay.
Right there.
Okay.
Hello. Thank you for being here. My name is Wayne. I'm a member of 350.org. Paris was a great event, but it only, even if everyone got and made their pledges, it would only bring the temperature down to, or restrain the temperature to about 2.7 degrees Celsius. So in that sense, Paris has not done what is needed. Your former predecessor, Dr. Chu, at a Stanford talk in 2014, had a metaphor at the end for a questioner that asked about the possibility of methane being a problematic, leading to runaway climate change. His answer was, it's like Russian roulette. You load a bullet into the gun, you give it to your grandchildren, and you say, pull the trigger. That's what we're doing, okay?
So thanks. We have a long line. I'm going to ask the secretary to respond to the ambition of Paris.
Do you agree with that level of danger that climate change is presenting for the entire world? And can we somehow increase the speed at which we're going to solve this problem? Because it's not an incremental problem.
So look, I think there's, well, we're all on the, well, I think we're all on the same page that obviously climate risks are one of the absolute major risks that we face, and we need to be aggressive in addressing it. Now, Paris, as you said, and I thought I pretty much said it, is that the Paris commitments in and of themselves will not take us to the 2 or even lower degree centigrade warming that we feel is prudent. Not ideal, but at least prudent. That's why, of course, those commitments are now made typically between 2025 and 2030. And so after that, we are going to need more ambition, maybe even before that. And that's why I said the other part of the story of Paris, which, of course, does not get as much attention after the end of Paris, is this innovation agenda. If we continue to innovate and drive down the costs of the clean technologies, that will permit the more aggressive ambition going forward. That's what I mean, that we, you know, we're not finished in 10 years, we're just starting in 10 years. And so the innovation is part of it, and it'll work together with policy to get us to the very low, very, very low carbon future that we need.
Let's have our next question for Secretary Moniz. Briefly,
hi,
please.
I'm a 30-year EPA employee, and when I started in 1984, we were talking about what are we going to do with the waste from nuclear power generation, and that's something that we're going to have to get on top of sometime. It's going to be an integrated process. There's no such thing as totally clean energy because we have to deal with that waste, so I'm hoping that there's a plan in place.
So the let me just say, actually, just last week, we had the first of a set of public hearings, public meetings to request information. I won't go into great detail, but what is called a consent-based process to all forms of nuclear spent fuel and high-level waste handling. Storage facilities, geological repositories, deep bore holes, which we are starting an experiment on. So we are launching kind of a new push towards all forms of managing the back end of the nuclear fuel cycle.
Next question.
Dave Masson, Citizens Climate Lobby. Thank you, Secretary Moniz, for your efforts in Paris. I understand that pricing carbon was not on the agenda there, but it was a part of important side discussions. What's your view of the role that pricing carbon, say a tax on fossil fuels, could play? And do you have hopes about a role for Congress in bringing that to the U.S.?
Well, I certainly feel that that pricing carbon is the simplest economy-wide approach to addressing carbon. Personally, I think that we will eventually get there. I think it's clear in the current political environment that we're not ready to get there immediately. But the administration, the president's climate action plan, is really addressing and accomplishing significant reductions through existing administrative authorities. The issue there is that in doing so, we therefore need to address it in some sense in a sectoral way, like the Clean Power Plan for power plants, the CAFE standards for vehicle efficiencies, etc. Ultimately, a carbon price would probably be the simplest way to get economy-wide and to, I think, to give the most certainty to industry and everyone else in terms of understanding the future.
We've had three questions from men. I'm going to ask the lady in the back. You jump forward because we've had a bunch of men on stage today and a bunch of men at the microphone. So, and also some generation. This is the last question. Welcome to Climate One.
Thank you. Hi, Lily Pike from Energy Innovation. Saw today that China announced a price floor for oil. I was wondering what your thoughts are on that and if the U.S. would ever consider such a policy.
Well, the Chinese, I think, are like others, taking advantage of the low oil prices to, in some cases, by the way, and I'm not saying about China specifically, but in many cases, countries that have been providing enormous subsidies are using the low oil price as a chance to lower the subsidies without having as big an impact on their consumers. But I think, look, I think the issue in the end is that we have to keep our focus, as we are in the United States, by the way, in terms of lowering our oil dependence. Even as we are producing more oil, you know, we are still big net oil, big crude oil importers. And so we will continue to address lowering oil dependence, again, through three principal thrusts: efficiency, alternative liquid fuels, electrification of vehicles. That's our program.
We have to end our first segment there. Our thanks to U.S. Secretary of Energy Ernest Moniz for his comments here today at Climate One at the Commonwealth Club. The Paris climate deal is backed by hundreds of corporations, including Apple, General Electric, IBM, and other icons of American industry. Bill Gates went to Paris to announce he is partnering with Richard Branson, Mark Zuckerberg, and other billionaires to create a new fund to invest in breakthrough technologies. We turn now to other companies and investors active on the clean energy front. Hal Harvey is CEO of Energy Innovation, a consulting group. He is formerly an executive with several philanthropic foundations. Danny Kennedy is managing director at CalCEF, the California Clean Energy Fund, a private equity and venture capital firm. He previously co-founded a solar rooftop company. Lyndon Rive is co-founder and CEO of Solar City, one of the country's largest installers of rooftop solar systems. Entrepreneur Elon Musk is chair of the Solar City board and Lyndon Rive's cousin. Please welcome them to Climate One at the Commonwealth Club. Hal Harvey, let's begin with you. You've said that there are two Americas, not a red America and a blue America, but a green America and a brown America. Tell us what you mean.
So with deference, of course, to Energy Secretary Moniz, a very large fraction of American energy policy is set state by state. 60% of the nation's carbon goes through monopoly pipes and wires. And those are regulated individually by state public utilities commissions. Those public utilities commissioners get to decide whether your utility bill lands on green choices or brown choices. And in states like California, which has near one-third renewable energy and will soon have 50% renewable energy, they're landing on green choices. But there are other states. Nevada recently made a horrible reversal, and they're insisting, in effect, that your money go to brown choices. So this is substantially driven state by state.
Lyndon Rive, there is some areas where clean energy is playing defense. Nevada's one. In Georgia, the state recently reduced incentives for electric vehicles. Sales plummeted. So tell us about where you're playing offense and where you're playing defense.
Right now, it just feels like we're playing defense left and right. The amount of attacks coming on to the solar industry is insane. Just coming back from Paris, you know, one of the big takeaways is the countries are investing now to make this change. But the only way you can truly make this change is you have to give the choice to the public. You have to enable the technology for the public to be actually use it. But if the monopoly is protecting their infrastructure and not allowing that change to occur, it's really difficult to make that happen. And Nevada is a classic case. The industry has done a great job of moving forward, reducing cost, making it more affordable, allowing more and more lower income neighborhoods to go solar. But then with one swipe of the pen, the PUC decimated the solar industry in Nevada. There is no solar industry. It's gone. So it's not like reduced, it's gone. And it's a shame, especially when it's a state where most of the energy is imported and most of it's coal and natural gas.
And how did that happen? Is it because the incumbent utilities have more influence at the state house? They have more muscle? How did that battle play out in Nevada, Harry Reid's home state?
So unless you have a legislation or a PC that wants to go and understands the importance of selecting green over brown, the incumbent infrastructure, the relationships they have and the investments they've made into policy has been going on for 100 years. And so that relationship is highly captive, and it's been going on. And so, for a long time, they made these investments. And so unless you can get the public to weigh in, you're going to end up with roughly the same result. And the result is protecting their profits.
Danny Kennedy, there is some upside here. Job growth, solar jobs are growing, solar deployment is growing. Tell us the positive side of the story.
Well, the truth is we've been succeeding as a clean energy industry now for over a decade, particularly in job creation, which should be important to all of us. Coming out of the recession, solar, for example, created a couple hundred thousand jobs. So that there are now more people employed in the solar industry than in the oil and gas extraction industry in America. There are now more solar installers, just that occupation, half of the value chain, if you will, than there are coal miners in America. And that's at less than 2% of electricity supplied. So as we grow to 10, 20, 50 in California, where we're under mandate to do so, we will employ many hundreds of thousands more Americans as these clean energy businesses grow. So great news story there. Plus, we're lowering costs of electricity for families and businesses across the country. Plus, we're cleaning the air and reducing the risks of climate change that we talked about. So a lot of good news, and that's a global story as well. I mean, what happened before Paris was that the previous 3 years, capital flows had been more on the side of clean energy than dirty. You know, so history has shifted, and the alternative energy, if you will, is no longer wind and solar, it's nukes and coal, actually, as a matter of where new capacity is being built. And that will only grow globally. And post-Paris, that number will expand by at least half again because of the commitments made by the diplomats there.
Lyndon Rive, the United States, except for Alaska and Hawaii, doesn't really burn oil for electricity, but there's been a lot of turmoil in the energy markets recently, creating question about renewable energy. How's that affecting your business? How's that affecting the outlook for renewable energy, all this concern and turmoil in the energy sector?
You know, the electricity is not driven by, well, at least not in the U.S., as you mentioned. Hawaii, small impact. But most of the cost is actually in transmission and distribution. So even with the cost of natural gas coming down and the utility's variable cost has essentially dropped in half, retail rates continue to increase. And when you have a business model where you get a regulated return on your cost, your motivation is to spend more money on the infrastructure. And so the only way we're going to truly change this and also reduce the friction between alternative energy and the incumbent is you got to change the revenue model. You can't be revenue of cost. It can be revenue of services, or it can be infrastructure as a service and enable competition into the market. As the secretary mentioned earlier, if you're going to really try to change this, you have to focus on technology. The number one driving factor for technology and technology innovation is competition. If you don't bring competition into the equation, what type of products would we have? If there was only one cell phone, how good would it be? Yes, it would make a call, but it wouldn't be a great phone. If there's only one car, it wouldn't be that great a car. Competition drives innovation. And so you have to open up this monopoly infrastructure, allow competition to build the infrastructure out. With that, innovation will occur. So that's what has to happen. Let's not depend on one company to build out the infrastructure. Let's allow 1,000 companies to build out that infrastructure and then have one company be the manager of it. That's fine. But if you do that, then innovation will occur.
Al Howery, that's starting to happen in California. There are places where people can make choices, various flavors, various colors of green. Is that happening across the United States where people can choose where they get their electrons from?
There are a number of electricity markets that have opened up to customer choice in different ways. And one interesting example, actually, is Texas. So the first renewable portfolio standard in the country was signed by Governor George W. Bush. They met that with wind in no time whatsoever. They doubled it, and they beat the records on that. Texas now has more than twice as much wind as California. It was initiated by policy. It was enabled by Texas's willingness to put in transmission lines to the wind field. So that was a certainty that a wind developer could look at and use right away. And finally, it was enabled by the possibility of bilateral sales so the wind companies could sell directly to the customers. And many customers preferred this. Some preferred it for environmental reasons, but many preferred it because the long-term price of wind is exactly the same as the short-term price of wind once the windmill's built. Zero fuel cost. That's an incredible advantage. So there are many ways to get at this, but fundamentally, public policy is an enabler or inhibitor. And the difference is clear in the markets that have happened. If you look at the dramatic decline of solar prices, 80% drop in the last 5 years, it was kicked off by good policy and enabled by further good policy. And that creates a zero carbon energy alternative that's entirely affordable.
On affordability, Lyndon Rive, last year, another cabinet secretary of President Obama, Julian Castro, was here, concerned about making green energy accessible and affordable to lower income Americans. It's perceived to be an elitist, upper middle class, coastal thing. So how is clean energy getting to less Americans with less income?
Yeah, so just to be clear, let's nail that one in the head. That's propaganda from the utilities. That's not the case, Kim. If you look at all the growth in the industry today, majority of it is in low to moderate income neighborhoods. So that's the majority. If we just looked at our installations in California, 38% of our installations are in zip codes with census tract with disadvantaged communities. So it's with the innovation of the technology and financing, you can provide a product where the homeowner can go solar. No investment, save money from day one. That product had a high credit criteria in the beginning, and now that criteria has come down and down and down, and now it's at 650 FICO instead of 720 when it started off. It's enabled most of the growth in the industry. 70% of the U.S. market is on that type of program, and it's made solar available to most homeowners.
Danny Kennedy, you look at the broad clean tech sectors. What are some of the hot sectors that you look at where you see a lot of excitement and promise?
There's a bunch of new work being done in storage, energy storage, which California is a real center of gravity for, with the national labs here engaged in consortia to help advance startups providing batteries and other forms of storage. I would say another area of innovation, to follow up what you were discussing with the Secretary, isn't just the hardware innovations that are needed, but the financial products and the software technologies that are needed to make this bidirectional grid that we're going to live with work. You know, and to speak to the solar industry's growth in America, much of that was facilitated by financial product changes and improvements and innovation in that arena. So, you know, financial engineers, software engineers of the world, get involved, because that's the startups that are needed as much as some new particular piece of hardware.
If you're just joining us, we're talking today at Climate One at the Commonwealth Club with Lyndon Rive from Solar City, Danny Kennedy from CalCEF, and Hal Harvey from Energy Innovation. I'm Greg Dalton. So, Lyndon Rive, what's needed to, what solar is what, 2% maybe of U.S. electricity now? What's needed to get it to 5, 10%? What's the path?
Yeah, this is where government can play a really important role. Having a policy that enables making use clean energy easier. Let's not make it harder. What we often find when we start getting traction is that when you get traction, the incumbents leverage their policy relationships to slow down the adoption. Like, oh wait, this is actually starting to work. We're actually starting to solve the problem. Let's make it harder. Wow, and they actually give presentations of like potential growth trajectories. Well, look how good it's going to grow. We've got to make sure that growth trajectory slows down. Like, thank goodness some states have really good leaders in this role, and it's up to them to make this work. And it's binary. If they do it right, growth occurs, we solve the problem. If they do it wrong, it decimates the market and there is no renewable energy.
How would you characterize California regulators' relationship with the incumbent, the large utilities?
I think California is one of the best states. I think our governor's doing a great job. I think our PUC is dealing with the challenge and doing a phenomenal job. So I think California is one of the best states.
Hal Harvey, California is often seen as a clean energy leader. It was seen as a clean energy leader in Paris very much, both at the city and state level. And yet California's success is not, its trajectory is not secured for the future. Some of the laws that Governor Schwarzenegger signed will expire. A new governor in California in 2018 could go in a very different direction. Is that true?
California enjoys what I call a virtuous cycle. So when you create good policy, you create good industries behind it. And you create workers for those industries and customers. And they become a new political force. So when Governor Brown was the youngest governor in California's history, he instituted a very progressive building code that self-tightens every 3 years. And at first, the builders were against this. And then they realized it levels the playing field and it keeps out the schlock. And so new products came along, better windows, better air conditioners, better roofing materials, better insulation, and buildings got more and more efficient. Every 3 years, the code tightened up. This survived through Duke Majan, Wilson, Schwarzenegger, Davis, I didn't get the order quite right, but Republican and Democratic governors alike. And that's where we're headed in California, and that's where we're headed nationally. Earlier, I said something about green and brown states. They're all going to be green states. The reason they're all going to be green states is because nobody wants to overpay for energy perennially. Nobody wants to be permanently dependent on fossil fuels. Nobody wants to subject their kids to asthma and particulate pollution. So there are leader states that take risks, but there are technologies which enable all states to come on board.
And on the California, though, the 2018, some things need to be done. I mean, there's sometimes an assumption that California is kind of coasting in this green lane. That could change.
There's always political risk here. One of my favorite policy design principles is continuous improvement. So I'll give the good example I just mentioned was the California building codes get tighter every 3 years. One political step, continuous improvement. The contrary example, which is a killer, after the first oil embargo, President Gerald Ford doubled fuel efficiency through CAFE standards from 13 miles per gallon to 26. And then they plateaued, essentially unmoving, until Obama doubled them again to 54. We wasted 25 years of innovation. We wasted 25 years of dramatic oil expenditures, almost all of which were sent to countries that hate us. $1 trillion in that time period. And we let the other companies continue to innovate because they had tougher standards. And so we innovated with cup holders, and they innovated with transmissions and engines and tires and chassis. So continuous improvement is a magic bullet, and that's one of the things that has to be built into legislation, including in California.
And Greg, can I jump in that by 2018, I think this virtuous cycle that has just been described is going to be even more entrenched in California with more jobs. You know, back to Lyndon's point also about the monopoly utilities, we now already employ more people in the solar industry than the five big utilities in the state, the IOUs and SMUD and Los Angeles Department of Water and Power. Plus, we're going to employ many more in the years to come and create these businesses that are then exportable to the world, that the ministers of 24 countries are coming to see in a showcase here in California in June of this year. You know, that's the next big wave. There's something in the order of $9 to $12 trillion in the next 25 years going to be spent on energy, not here, but in other countries. California wants a piece of that action. I can't imagine our politicians and leaders in 3 years' time stepping backwards from their leadership position.
It's actually some competition between California, Oregon, and Washington for those jobs, and their governors claiming that their clean policies are driving economic growth and job growth. We're talking about the economy and innovation at Climate One. We're going to go to our lightning round question and ask you brief yes or no questions. We'll see if you did better than our previous. Danny Kennedy, the U.S. government should help coal workers losing their jobs due to cheap natural gas and solar power. Yes or no?
Absolutely, they should.
Lyndon Rive, Tesla, who is a corporate cousin of SolarCity, has a market capitalization of $25 billion. Last year, it sold less than 50,000 cars. That's a valuation of $500,000 for cars that it sells for $100,000. That is a sign of a bubble.
I may be biased in my comment, but I think we're going to have 100% all electric in the future. So if you look at how many cars there actually are and what the transformation is going to look like, I think it's undervalued.
Hal Harvey, a homeowner who has the money for rooftop solar is better off buying it than leasing it from an installer.
Yes.
Lyndon Rive, clean tech companies do a good job hiring and promoting minorities and women.
Actually, we do. Yeah, really well.
Danny Kennedy, a young child today will fly on a battery-powered airplane in their lifetime.
Yes, they will.
Last one, Hal Harvey, China will be the clean tech leader of the 21st century.
If we don't wake up. Actually, we're on our way, but it's going to be a race.
All right, that ends our lightning round. How did they do? I think they did pretty well. Hal Harvey, you've said that America has become somewhat of a petrostate, dependent on resource extraction. What do you mean by that?
We had an amazing boom, first of natural gas from fracking, and then from oil from fracking. And the U.S. became one of the dominant world oil producers after years of decline. And there are some parts of Texas and most of North Dakota and other states, Pennsylvania, for example, where there were fantastic revenues and a lot of jobs created. The problem becomes, there's an environmental problem to this, of course, but the economic problem becomes if you become so dependent on those natural resources that you fall into the trap where we find Russia, Venezuela, Iran, where if you can't sell that oil at a good price, your economy tanks. So it's perfectly fine to responsibly use our natural resources. It's a terrible idea to get addicted to natural resource extraction. It's called the resource curse, and we should avoid it.
All right, let's talk about the Paris deal. We heard earlier that it's lacking in ambition. Hal Harvey, what do you think of the Paris deal? Is it just a gesture, or is it a meaningful step forward?
It's a real deal. What's important about Paris, the most important thing about Paris is that everybody came to the table with a plan to decarbonize their economy. And what will matter is whether that gets done. What Paris did was sanctify the political movement and create momentum. Where we have to turn our attention now, and this is absolutely crucial, is especially in the big nations, helping ensure that they end up with the right building codes, the right utility policy, the right and the end to subsidy of fossil fuels. So it's the nuts and bolts sector by sector, policy actions that go away from Paris in the top 20 countries that determine our climate future. It's that simple.
Lyndon Rive, the Paris deal is going to affect solar cities' growth, going to affect the solar industry. Does that help you?
Absolutely. I mean, when you look at developing countries, solar is clearly something that can help them. It helps with grid stability when you start adding storage to it as well. The big challenge now in developing countries is financeability. So it's not a technology issue. The technology is available, but it's financeability. So out of our Paris is commitments from the developed countries to help with the financing. And so it'll take a while for that to go through the system and how you actually get access to the financing. But when that access to the financing becomes available, you'll see a lot more deployment of renewable energy in the developing countries.
Danny Kennedy, where can an average investor put some money into a mutual fund? They want to invest in solar. They did that in the 70s, 80s, or 90s. People got burned badly. Where can people do it today?
I'm obviously not going to provide investment advice on the radio, but there's plenty of good companies out there, plenty of funds that retail investors can actually get involved with, and there are going to be increasing flows of bonds and various forms of debt to get behind this amazing capital flow, which will be unleashed by Paris. You know, to Hal's point, I think the key is going to be what actually is done after the words, and if the ratchet mechanisms are used to create a virtuous spiral like we've had in California here with policy over time. If that is the case, then as I mentioned earlier, there's some estimates that suggest, you know, the amount of money flowing into renewable energy will go from something like $6 trillion in the next 25 years to 9 or 12 trillion, depending on how much of the pie we take in terms of new energy. So are there flows of capital required? Yes. Are there opportunities for investors? Yes. Right now there's a gap globally of about $200 billion annually, but just by the measure of like the US mortgage market, that's less than a fifth of what we spend on mortgages annually in this country, or less than half of what we spend on auto loans. So sounds like big numbers, but the world can get to that 1.5 degree kind of goal set in Paris if we unleash another couple hundred billion dollars into this area. And that's jobs, economic growth, equity for families. It's all good news.
Danny Kennedy is managing director at CalCEF. Our other guests today at Climate One are Hal Harvey from Energy Innovation and Lyndon Rive from Solar City. I'm Greg Dalton. We're going to invite your participation for the last 10 minutes, and I may shuffle the deck again, depending on how the line works out up there. So invite you to go up there and join us with a brief question for these three gentlemen, and give you a moment to get over there. Let's go to our
thanks, everyone, for coming. I had a question for Secretary Moniz, but I can address the same question to you guys. Roles do you see in the innovation areas of solar thermal, say, in the southwest of the United States? And connected with that, perhaps, would be DC transmission from the southwest to consumption areas.
Lyndon Rive, solar thermal, heating water with the sun. It happens in other parts of the world. How about here?
Yeah, I mean, we've looked at it. We looked at it a little while ago, and the economics just didn't pencil out. Will it pencil out in the future? Maybe. Right now, it's not something that we put in big focus on it. Now, our business model is mainly distributed, so it's a different answer when you're looking at larger scale. But for us, we haven't spent much time on it.
The other part was a DC transmission. A lot of electricity is AC, DC. There's less line loss. Goes about. Who'd like to tackle that one?
I think Danny nothing's Kennedy? Off the table to the Secretary's point earlier. You know, we're going to need all of the above probably in terms of innovation areas with clean energy. And DC in particular is going to be an important part of the electricity future. So it's one of the areas where startups can get going.
Let's have our next question. Welcome to Commonwealth Club.
A theme that we've heard today is the economic potential of the clean energy transition. I was at a panel at the Cleantech Forum just a couple hours ago where they were talking about robots and automation in the work in the industrial force. Can you speak to how that fits into this picture long term in the future?
Yeah, absolutely. And we're just going through this right now. We're both building a factory in New York. It's going to be the largest solar manufacturing factory in the Western Hemisphere. And we're looking at automation and the robots moving things around. There's a lot of innovation that can occur there. Those robots are super expensive. It makes no sense when you do bottoms-up cost analysis of what those robots should cost. And they clunky. They actually don't provide such great automation. So it's a very challenging part of the manufacturing. And I think there could be a tremendous innovation there.
That's tough news for people hoping on that plant in Buffalo will create lots of jobs. Is there a tension there between the robots and the job creation?
So the number one job creator in the solar industry is actually delivering solar on somebody's house. Yes, even if you automate the full factory, you're still going to create a lot of jobs. But the manufacturing has this appeal that it's the elite jobs, but installers make more money. They you know, good installers can make a good income, and it is highly distributed. It's not concentrated, so everybody gets the benefit of the job creation versus just one specific location, and the ratio is like dramatically different. Like our factory in Buffalo is going to make about a gigawatt. The forecast is about 1,500 people in that factory. Today we install about a gigawatt as a company, and we have 15,000 employees. So it's a big delta.
And those installation jobs can't be shipped offshore to China. Let's go to our next question. Welcome.
Hi there. Oliver Harris here from Tower Power. Just focusing on some of the poorest parts of the world where people don't have access to energy at all, what's your view on the role of distributed renewable energy microgrids to provide the power that they need?
Yeah.
Favorite subject, because
Danny Kennedy.
I think a lot of people don't realize that there are more people on Earth today that don't have electricity than when Edison started the whole electrification thing. And so there's going to be an enormous growth of that over the next several decades. So of that sort of multi-trillion dollar market, sounds like funny money, much of it is going to be bottom of the pyramid, if you will, bringing light and other electricity services to people of Asia, the half of India that doesn't have electricity to date, and all of Africa, including the burgeoning population there. So it's an enormous space, it's an enormous opportunity to do good and uplift lives, and it's already booming. I mean, I think the off-grid electric scene is becoming a hot market, if you will, a bit like the solar industry here in America about 8-7 years ago. Bunch of announcements at this forum that people are at this week in San Francisco of funding and equity rounds and all that sort of good news. And hopefully that will just grow globally as we deliver this thing we all take for granted called electricity, but which can really improve people's lives across the globe.
Yeah, we're super passionate for that. We've invested in a company actually called Off-Grid Electric in Tanzania. And the model is essentially displacing kerosene. And it's a small solar panel, 4 or 6 LED lights, little battery. It provides a far better form of light, way healthier, and way safer, at a lower price than just burning kerosene. So you think of the sales model. You're coming home one day, and you got your neighbor with this nice light hanging out, and versus you and with your little kerosene lamp, and you ask your neighbor, "How'd you get that?" And your neighbor tells you it's cheaper than the kerosene, so it's going to be massive, massive growth in that sector.
Lyndon Wright is CEO of Solar City. Let's go to our next question.
Hi, thanks for coming and speaking with us this evening. So we've talked a lot about Paris and you know, how to make sure there's action after the talks. And Mr. Harvey, I'd love for you to talk to us about how you think countries are going to keep each other keep each other honest to their own commitments, and specifically the role that the United States will play in that.
One of the elements of tension in the Paris talks was this question of transparency, monitoring, and verifying these changes. And the U.S. fielded a pretty brilliant team of negotiators and made great progress on this. And I think China's interest in transparency has been an enormous step in the right way. So I think the actual monitoring of progress is going to be pluralistic. There's a lot of citizen observations we can see. There's more and more web reporting. More and more sensing is unfolding across the world that lets us see what's being used and what's being burned. You can do a lot of this with what they call national technical means without necessarily believing what's self-reported. So I think we're going to have report cards on the web for every major country that tell you how things are going. What's more important, or at least as important, is that the citizens of those countries demand increased energy efficiency and increased renewable energy, cleaner air, and reduced climate risk. Because it's the domestic political pressure, not the international political pressure, that's going to make the big difference. And then finally, the main narrative of Paris, from my perspective, was Copenhagen was all about burden sharing, and Paris was all about opportunity. Mm-hmm. And that's a 180 switch. So you don't need to have such draconian measures when it turns out to be in your economic interest to do the right thing. It's not a done deal. It's not a coasting slope downhill all the way. I don't want to be sanguine about this, but the wind is definitely at our back.
Let's go to our last question. Welcome.
Hi, thank you. My name is Lisa Altieri. This California CPUC has a big decision to make this Thursday on net metering California. So far the draft proposal looks good, but there's been pressure to change it. We hope that you're right about California continuing to be a leader and the CPUC does the right thing. My question is, how long do you see it taking for battery technology to advance to the point where net metering is no longer key for homeowners, where homeowners can just install their own battery, go off grid, and not need the utility to do this?
And Lyndon Rive, let's hedge a little bit here because people will hear this on the radio after that's decided, so you can hedge, like, depending on which way it goes, the decision
You
goes.
Have two answers.
So I have full faith in our PUC, and I'm convinced that they'll make the right decision. So in terms of answering the question of how long it will take for batteries to actually to be as a technology so you don't have to net meter, let me just address the issue, the fundamental issue. The fundamental issue is actually not net metering. There is no cost shift associated with net metering. There's a revenue loss. So if you go with battery, you still lose the revenue. So if you find a technology where it's solar with storage and you actually have grid defection, that's because of bad policy. That's the only reason. It's a bad design. It's not the right design. It's bad policy. You want to use the grid. You just want to enable it that you get fair compensation if you provide services to the grid. And I think what will happen is you still get, this is my forecast, you still get full retail and net metering over time, but then the solar industry has to provide more services. So today we just provide energy. We don't provide additional services beyond energy. Fast forward one more year, we have to provide reactive power with smart inversions. Fast forward, call it another 3 or 4 years, then we have to provide demand, like capacity, actual power, not energy. And so for that, in exchange, we get net metering. And that's where I think it will evolve to over time. The solar industry has to provide more services, evolve, and actually address some of the grid concerns. And I think that's where we end up.
One person I heard say that the future of electric utilities will be something like eBay and UPS. There'll be markets and delivering and kind of in that kind of delivery value-added service. We're out of time. We have to thank our Danny Kennedy from CalCEF, Lyndon Rive from SolarCity, and Hal Harvey from Energy Innovation. Thank them for joining. You can join the conversation on Twitter using our handle @ClimateOne. Thank to our audience here and online.